Welcome to Memphis Metropolis on WYXR 91.7 FM. I'm your host, Emily Trenum. Memphis Metropolis is all about our city as an urban place, including its neighborhoods, buildings, pathways, and parks, as well as the people who shape it. Join us each week as community leaders and commentators talk with me about our shared built environment. Welcome back to Memphis Metropolis on WYXR 91.7 FM. I'm Emily Trenum, and I'm the Memphis Metropolis host. And in this show, we're talking about parks and how Memphis compares to other cities in terms of access to parks, among other things. And my guests are Noel Durant, who's with the Trust for Public Land. I guess you're in Chattanooga, is that right, Noel? Okay.
That is correct. Yep.
Okay. Our state office. Trust for Public Land. And then Joanne Street, who is the founder and director of an organization that has the best name ever, which is HUG. And it's a park friends group for three parks in North Memphis. And so welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
So
thank you for having us.
Dive into parks, and we're going to talk about park scores. And before we dive into that, I'd love the two of you to introduce yourselves a little bit. So, Noel, starting with you, what is the Trust for Public Land in a nutshell?
Yeah, the Trust for Public Land is one of the only national conservation organizations focused on people. And we, as an organization across our 30 field offices, are dedicated to connecting everyone to the outdoors, be it through the creation of parks and trails, protecting public land, or creating publicly accessible schoolyards. We are focused on protecting land and creating parks for people to ensure healthy and livable communities
okay,
for generations
great.
To come.
And Joanne, what is HUG? Tell me about that.
Well, thank you, Emily. HUG is an acronym for three parks that are in the North Memphis area: Hollywood Park, University Park, and Gooch Park and Pool. Gooch is located at 1974 Hunter Avenue, and right down the street is University Park. And everyone says, why are there two parks so close to one another? The neighborhoods used to be segregated. And it wasn't until 1964 when parks were desegregated by a United States Supreme Court order, but the kids always play together. No one paid attention to that. And Hollywood Park is where our community center is. It's where all our community comes to sing, laugh, dance, play, and just have their being. So one person remarked today, why isn't every neighborhood like this one? I'm like, there is no.
You know, there are quite a few parks in North Memphis. So which of the parks, University or Gooch, historically served African Americans?
It was Gooch Park and Pool. It was founded by Cecil Milton Gooch and his wife, Boris Alexander Gooch. It was dedicated to the city November 24th, 1957.
Okay. And tell me about when you founded HUG. What prompted you to do that?
Well, the parks are the place where everyone goes to be active and share the outdoors and meet their neighbors. And we noticed a decline in the maintenance of our parks. And that meant that advocacy was just going to be the next step. And because our children had no place to go and play. And as a result, I'm not sure if you know, we have a real bad problem in our neighborhood with lead exposure to children. And then we've also gone through a pandemic. So you had children being inside, indoors, and suffering various emotional depression, suffering from asthma and respiratory-related illnesses. And how can we counter that but with the sun and have the sun kiss their skin, and then we hug their little bodies and put them out there and introduce them to organized play. And actually we planted flowers, we planted trees. We did things that we thought were sustainable. And as we noticed, as a result, the kids were more active, and of course providing nutritious whole foods to them, oranges, apples, feeding them in summer play, introducing baseball, sometimes just laying in the grass and looking up at the sky. and we opened the pools and we saw this is what we need because these are our future.
So, I mean, and what you said a minute ago, like, why doesn't every neighborhood have this? I mean, that's sort of what we're talking about today. So, Noel, your organization publishes an index every year called the Park Score Index, where you rate the 100 cities on their park score. So before we talk about Memphis, just what is Park Score and what do you look at in calculating a location's park score?
Yeah, so Park Score is based equally on five factors for a city's park system. It includes park access, which measures the total percentage of residents that live within a 10-minute walk, approximately a half mile of a park. It measures park equity, which compares park space per person in neighborhoods where residents identify as people of color versus white residents or lower income versus higher income neighborhoods. It looks at park acreage, which is based on the city's median park size and the percentage of total city area dedicated to parks. Looks at park investment, which measures the park spending per resident, and then park amenities that counts the availability of six popular park features, basketball hoops, off-leash dog parks, playgrounds, splash pads, and other water play structures, and recreation and senior centers.
So do you look at, those? I mean, I don't want to get too far afield, although I'm a big digressor. Do you look at that sort of collectively, or do you look at disparity at all? Because for sure in Memphis, I mean, we're doing a lot of investments in parks now, and we can talk about that later. But historically, the North Memphis is the world. You know, the parks were not well maintained, but the newer, we've had a lot of sprawl. You've got these beautiful new facilities in the suburbs. Do you look at disparity at all?
The disparity really probably comes in to both the access and equity components of the park score, and that's meant to really understand who has access to parks and who doesn't. On the amenity side, it's a little harder to drill into that very sort of nuanced geographic area of focus. But I do think when you look at those categories, those priorities as a whole, you can get a sense of how these parks are distributed across the city, and a rough idea, an approximation of how well these facilities are maintained in terms of spending. But again, and as we talk specific about Memphis's park score performance, especially its rise in the last year, some of that story isn't quite told in park score as it's captured to date. So yeah, there's a challenge for us to be able to drill down within a city to find out where there are gaps. It's probably best captured in our access component as well as in the
Well, let's talk
component.
About Memphis, because I think, Memphis has some, nationally known parks, Shelby Farms Park, Overton Park, the parks along the river. And I think, Memphis is proud of its parks. And of course, for people who live in the loop, the 240 loop, where the urban neighborhoods, I think I don't know about being half a mile away, but there's quite a few parks, even in neighborhoods like North Memphis, South Memphis, there's quite a few parks, but yet we only scored 74 out of 100 on the park scores. So that impression that I had that we were well-parked was somewhat unfounded. So elaborate on our score a little bit and what contributed to it.
Yeah. Yep. So there's across all of those categories that I mentioned, there is two that trend really close or above average in terms of scoring. So these scores are based on 0 to 100. So Memphis, for example, was in the 59th, scored 59 out of 100 in terms of acreage for parks. So that says it's trending a higher than average amount of land per park, an overall percentage of the city that is parkland. But at the same time, Memphis ranked or had a score of 16 out of 100 as it relates to access. So very low walkable access to parks in comparison to other communities that might be in the top 10 that are in that 90 90 out of 100 score range. So the walkability is a real challenge for Memphis in park score. Another shining star for Memphis in terms of is in the investment category, that spending was scored 49 out of 100, which was really where I think Memphis made the jump in its park score performance, jumping 14 spots in the 2023 park score in comparison.
So we moved up. That's what you're saying.
You did. You moved up. There's only three other cities that moved up, had a higher jump in park score. That included North Las Vegas, Tampa, Florida, and Boise. But Memphis was really focused on the significant increase in citywide spending, both in terms of bond money, philanthropy for those signature park assets.
Joanne, you talked about this, and I want you to elaborate on it in a minute. But Noel, while we're still with you, why is this important?
Well, park score is important because it's an annual measure that gives both information to city officials as well as residents around relative strength of their park system. And before park score was enacted, there wasn't this sort of nationwide dialogue around what makes a high quality park system and what are those measures that communities should be looking to, what are those measures that residents should be looking for in a high quality park system. So it creates, and it's not perfect, but it creates a good system of measure by which each year when park score is released, we get to have these conversations around how cities are faring, how are they reacting to a greater need or greater desire for park access, more equitable access, greater investment in parks, better amenities. So that's the intent behind park score, is to really provide a measure of quality for our park systems across the country and drive cities to increase.
So Joanne, I want to talk a little more about individuals and families and why it's important, but what's your perspective on, you know, Memphis's score overall? How do you feel like we're getting better? Or, cause I know you're not just involved with HUG, you pay attention, you're an activist in sort of parks advocacy generally. So what's your reaction to the score and thoughts you have about it?
Well, I just want to thank Noel for being there and creating the park score. It does give us a measuring tool to say, what's the usage of this park? How many children do we have? And you know that by how many children are fed in the park, because the food that's provided by Nutrition Services is scored on every sheet. So we were feeding, when we started, 120 children per day in the park, and people reported that we were running an illegal summer camp, but we were just we were just feeding the children and letting them know through the data, we collected data, how many kids we were feeding the day. And then we shared the information on anyone else who wanted to feed children. They didn't know where to get the food. And we said, you can get the food. And so food trucks were delivering food to all the parks and green spaces and people's churches. And kids were literally running from one place to the other. Before we had children who were committing shoplifting because they were hungry in the summertime. And six-year-olds were being taken into custody. We shouldn't have that. It shouldn't hurt to be a child. So once we did that, we sort of calmed the crime prevention part of it. And so children just walk up to you and say, can I play? And they don't even know what we're doing. I was like, this is tennis. So they bring their little flip-flops and say, this is what I wear. They didn't know. So we had 2 8-week community tennis classes that completed at University Park. And two of the children were so good, they're now in tournaments.
That's amazing.
And so as a result, yeah, the United States Tennis Association of Tennessee decided they wanted to make that spot a National Junior Tennis League because they didn't know we had that type of involvement. We had 50 children to show up saying they wanted to play tennis and their parents. So that's community engagement. And they said, how did you get 50 children out here? I was like, we just said we were playing and we had food and that's all it took. So now we have volunteers again. We clean the park. The kids will keep the park clean because they call it our park. See, that's we're teaching them how to be stakeholders. We teach them how to call 311 and say the grass is too high, report what's going on in your neighborhood. That's going to bring in street sweeper trucks. That brings in Memphis City Beautiful, Clean Memphis, Public Works. See, it's given us some kind of connectivity. And so when we were cleaning the park at Gooch Park, the company next door said, who's cleaning up the park? So they contacted the city to find out who we were. And then they joined in. And then they said, well, we can paint the park. So that's the company's called Buckman International. So they helped us open the pool. They had some kind of water treatment called Acumen that they could sort of advertise and say, this is what we're doing for the neighborhood. The water was so pretty. Everyone was saying how pretty the water was. And that brought in Urban Arts Commission. So see, we're bringing, everybody says, okay, it's okay to come over there. It's all right. And we have a wall mural that's on there that became a documentary called Slice. And it just keeps getting better on and on. So our park users, they said, Gooch is one of the most active parks one person said they'd ever seen. And people want to come over there.
Well, and you touched on so many important points. I mean, one of which is that, you know, certainly in my time living in Memphis, you know, in neighborhoods that had parks, people didn't want to use them. They were not well maintained. You know, the brush was overgrown. They didn't feel safe. And so basically, you know, you've got a high park score, but you don't. So I guess it's not just the park itself isn't enough. You need the community engagement to layer on top of it. Because one of the things I wanted to ask you about, Joanne, and you've probably sort of answered this, is, you know, we've talked about how important parks are to individuals, but to a neighborhood. I mean, it just seems like it's just an incredible if it's used, maintained, there's activities.
Yes, I just want to also say it brands the neighborhood. One thing that we know who's in New Chicago Park. We have formed a group. We call ourselves the Adopt a Park, Adopt a Parkers or whatever. I think it's like we're just coordinators. But what we do is we have a group in 19 parks in North Memphis. Now, that's 19 groups, at least 2 to 3 people in every park. Everybody calling 311 if they see something that's out of kilter at the park. They call 911 if they see negative activity. So that's going to give the police or any of our first responders a connective person to say what's going on in the park. If I want to know what's going on in the park, I'm not there. I just call Miss Cabot. She's on Hubert. She says, I saw something happening in the park. I could see it from my house. So it gives people, if they don't want to call the police, they can just call the park adopter, or they'll call one of the City Beautiful offices. I'll give you one example. There was one man who advertised on Facebook, if you want your car fixed, come over to Gooch Park. He put it on Facebook, and I was like, this is ridiculous. So I go over there, and there he is. He's about to put brakes on a car. And so I said, well, I need to call this in. So I call it in, and he saw me. He said, Joanne, did you call the police on me? I said, what were you doing? Because I didn't know he saw me, because I think it was Cabot called. And so he said, I was getting ready to put my brakes on my car. I said, what were you doing that for? So even he said, well, the police told me to stop. They didn't do anything to me. I was like, well, okay, well, we know not to do that. This is where the children have their lunch. And so maybe that's not a good thing. Maybe you should put your brakes on at your house or go to the neighbor tire store down the street. And so it was like a Barney Fife moment or something like that. But now they formed the 901 Boys, and they cook fish in the park for that's the children great. Every Sunday. And this Sunday, they're going to do the Father's Day. So we do Father's Day, Mother's Day. We celebrated our elders, the youngest being 79, the oldest 104. And they had like 70 participants, and the city came out. So people running for office came out. So it's just like bringing everybody. We had a parade from Hollywood Community Center, and our car is all the way down. And so we had teachers. I didn't know Miss Winfrey was 104. She's 105 this year. They just took her driver's license. And so she can't drive. So you see, these stories are that I am telling everyone is what's been passed down to me by rote. When the artist painted on the wall, he painted the stories that the people told him. And everybody looked at the wall and they said, that looks like me. And somebody else says, that looks like me. And so everybody thought it looked like them. I'm like, there is no way that could be them, but I didn't say that. And Mr. and Mrs. Gooch, they did so much in the community. And like I say, they everybody knows them. And I don't know how. So we're telling the other children by rote, there's somebody that cared about you. So we know we have to step in the gap. I've seen children with their moms in wheelchairs come to the park and them standing beside the basketball court. And the child said, mother, can I go and play? And I said, I'll stay here with your mom if you want to go and play basketball. So, you know, we didn't have a lot of money, but we had each other. And so the parks are where we meet. That's our alma mater. And our crime is down because we formed the crime prevention. We're crime prevention without being, you know, so obtruse that we say, oh, yeah, I saw you commit the crime. But this time we're like, we get you before you commit the crime because we want to know, are you thirsty? You want a sandwich? You know, before you get there, do you have a job? You know, your dad's coming home from prison. You know, we'll celebrate that. And they're so proud their dad's coming home. So these are memories that they have. And I just want to say this last thing. Since we've been doing this, we were organized in 2015. We've seen children graduate from high school, going to college, majoring in criminal justice and environmental justice. So they see them as the same. And people, their mother said, why are they majoring in that? I said, I have no idea. You know, and we know they became counselors with nonprofits to help. They want to know how they can help. And they think that if they, and they have good grades. And people say, well, somebody from this neighborhood, they have this future. But no, not if we, not if you keep them a place where we can.
Those are some great stories, really, about the great impacts that parks can have. So if you're just joining us, you're listening to Memphis Metropolis on WYXR 91.7 FM, and I'm talking to Noel Durant from the Trust for Public Land and Joanne Street from HUG here in Memphis. So, Noel, turning back to you for a minute, you know, the Memphis is, you've been to Memphis. It's really a very sprawling community, and we have very little density. It's mostly single family homes. And I got to think that development has contributed to our low park score because, you know, inside the city, there are quite a few parks. Do you see that other places as well? Cities that are just really sprawling that don't, might have big suburban regional parks, but do not have neighborhood parks.
Yep, that development pattern exists across the country. And I think that is a challenge, especially where you have sort of the urban core, the historic center of the city, where many times those parks were sort of planned out as the city grew when it wasn't auto dependent. And then you hit the post-war era where development is sort of married to the automobile, and you lose that park development paradigm where parks are developed in concert with population growth. There are a few communities that have bucked that trend, but they're often very new cities. So for example, the city of Henderson, Nevada has a requisite park acres per new building permits that developers have to build park access as they're developing new housing. So that's a way that communities are scaling park access as communities grow, but that city is also very young in comparison to Memphis. So I do think that when you have low density sprawl, park access is a challenge. And a great example in Tennessee would be Nashville as well. Large land area city, low density. And where Park Score started 12 years ago, it was mostly focused on walkable access. And we've been continuing to refine the methodology to try to point to an overall quality park network, despite the variation in population density. Still not perfect, large sprawling communities aren't able to compete on the access piece as well as those more dense communities, like you think of a planned city like Washington, D.C., great example of where you have the density, where you have the park access.
Are there cities that don't have a lot of density that have a higher, I mean, I know you probably don't have the list memorized, but that besides Henderson, Nevada, which you mentioned is newer, are there other cities that have our same kind of development pattern that you think have done a better job?
Yeah, actually, there's a part of the ParkScore tool that allows you to take a look at some of the methodology. And a community that is sort of larger in land area, lower in density, that has done pretty well, Kansas City is a great example of a city that has done a good job with growth to scale park access, maintain high quality facilities. So they're trending on, you know, above the average in every one of their those categories that we measure. And they sort of fit in that same mix in terms of size and density.
Well, we're having a lot of investment in parks right now, which we haven't in. I mean, Memphis has invested very. In fact, it was disinvesting for a long time. We're having a lot of investment in our parks right now. The parks, you know, division did a plan. Nick Walker was on the show talking about that, and then you know the mayor is investing a lot of money in parks and community centers. They're getting splash pads. I think everything is getting at least a coat of paint, yeah. and some are getting a lot more, and which is badly needed. But I guess the question is, you know, will that? I mean, I don't want to be fixated on the score, although I think it's a measure, but will that improve our score? And I mean, how do cities like Memphis improve their score? I mean, parks are expensive.
They are. It's a great question. So yes, continued investment in parks. And actually, Memphis is the shining star in sort of growing park spending. Memphis has doubled its expenditure in parks in the last 5 years. That is an impressive stat that showcases a commitment to parks by city leadership, and it's fantastic. At the same time, park expenditures from a ParkScore methodology is only one component. And when you have capital expenditures, bonds, for example, you might run out of those dedicated funds. So one of the ways that we are seeing cities really scale park access without a significant amount of increased spending is in partnerships for park access, specifically looking at community use agreements for school system facilities, public school facilities. For example, Boise, Idaho executed a joint use agreement between their park system and city schools this past year that increased park access by 5%. In 2022, Cincinnati jumped from 8 to number 4 because of a use agreement for recreation access to school facilities. So that's a way that communities are really jumping in their park access metrics is through partnering for access.
We do some of that here, I think. That's basically when, you know, a school's underutilized walking paths, playgrounds, basketball courts basically can be used by the public and it becomes a de facto park, right? That's what you're talking about.
Yes, that's correct. And usually there's a couple of different ways that that happens. Sometimes it's at the discretion of the principal around which schools are willing to provide that access. In these cases, what you end up with is a system-wide policy that's put into place. So it's not on a case-by-case basis. And those case-by-case bases are an excellent tool for a primary intervention in a neighborhood. But if you're trying to scale park access, looking holistically at the entire school system is where you really make a significant jump in access. And again, it's not the only component. I think you also need to think about the quality of the facilities at those school sites. And TPL nationally, in some of our research around community schoolyards, between 1% and 5% of existing school facilities are designed to function as a neighborhood park. So there's a huge opportunity to think about investing in some of those additional amenities that would take a school playground and turn that into a functioning park system with those amenities that make it more usable for the community after hours, on weekends, when school's not in session. So that's where a place where the organization Trust for Public Land is working to invest heavily, is thinking how we can support cities and school districts to pursue community use agreements, and then find ways to make very targeted investments on school campuses that are reflective of the community, what the community sees as a need for park access. Also, oftentimes, these schoolyards are designed by students. So it's a really integrated approach that ideally, when you finish a schoolyard, the school is now more ingrained into the fabric of the neighborhood. They become a place where residents who might not have a kid in school can find a source of pride in that neighborhood identity in the school space. So that's something we are seeing across the country as a growing opportunity for park access.
Can I jump in there real quick and say something? We were able to do a program called Pitch, Hit, and Run, where we got students to come and pitch, hit, and run a baseball, and their scores would go into the national database. We got the schools to partner with us. Then we got with the Redbirds baseball team for their inner city baseball program called RBI. And as a result, they gave us equipment and a grant. And that school formed a baseball team, which won two championships.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, Joanne, aside from the school strategy, do you have any ideas about how you think Memphis ought to increase access to parks? I realize that's like, how do you climb Mount Everest? I mean, that's a hard question, but you've sort of observed it.
Well, what we do through the Adopt a Park program through Memphis City Beautiful is we start talking about clean and beautify. So that was their mantra, clean up, paint up, fix up. I remember when it first started. So we get people to, you always get people to criticize that park is so dirty. And they're calling the city individually, but nothing's happening. So I said, what if we do it together? So I might go to a park and say, hey, you want to form a group? You know, who's the person in your neighborhood who cares? And we'll make that person a neighborhood leader. And you'd be surprised, you give them a vest and a pickup grabber, and they'll have everybody out there picking up paper. And then you have the block party, and then there's your group. And so that person's going to be connected either with the church or some staple in the neighborhood. That's going to mean that now there's community engagement and people know each other. So I said, you know, you can have a family picnic, you can have a school reunion. They didn't know you could do all these things. So I said, you know, remember, I'm bringing you garbage bags so you guys can pick up, register your event with the park services. So now the park services know who in the neighborhood cares about these parks. And so if there's a tragedy, they've got somebody in that neighborhood who saw something that feels some kind of civic responsibility. You know, you have civic engagement, but people know they have a responsibility in the neighborhood. So it's quite, it's really almost like a Barney Fife type of neighborhood, because it's closer. And then now the businesses want to get involved. So that's the thing. How can they help? Because instead of saying we need more security, now they just need to connect with somebody. And then that person goes out and says, you know, that business over there, they're pretty cool, you know, and they want to participate in our food giveaway, our Christmas giveaway. And so we're buying bikes from the hardware stores, and we're buying equipment to improve the area. I said, here's your grabber. We got a lawnmower. You know, you say you go to Hollywood Furniture Store and say, we're cleaning the park again. They say, oh, I know. I got your grabbers. I got your dustpans. And so it's and then we have food. And so now we're getting a grocery store. After over 30 years of this investment, we've got a grocery store, and it was wall to wall. There was no standing room only. To talk about getting a grocery store, and we say we don't care what it is, you know. Even though we know we can get on transportation, we can get in a car and go to a grocery store, but it's a sense of pride. We have a grocery store. We're like everyone else, but transportation has always been a barrier to us getting access to food. If you don't have a car, you won't be able to find an apple in the neighborhood because they have mostly processed food at the corner stores. But now just being able to get an apple, and we got together so many people distributing food boxes from the food bank. And so now we know those people. So we don't worry. We have the kids. You don't have to worry. If you don't have food, we can grow things. Look at this. Let's give everybody a little pot and show them how to grow something. They're like, oh my God. And so gardens are going up. And so there's a Curry Avenue garden. They were like, come join our garden. I'm like, I'm already busy. They're like, you come over here to our garden. And I'm like, okay, now Andrea has a garden at her big mama's house over there. And so we have to go over there. And then we have a bunch of people with orange shirts. They're called the Memphis Lift. They advocate for kids and show the parents how to advocate for their children. I'm not sure if you saw the news, but this group, they have a block party in the park. And they bring everything. We have gospel concerts. Because now they get all the people together and say, our kids are failing the third grade. What are you talking about? And so they're down at the school board. All that started, they met at the park, and then they go to the school board. I don't know how to explain it, but I don't know. We couldn't have done it without people like Noel.
You're doing a great job of explaining it. So Noel, Joanne touched on something that I want to circle back to, which is transportation. The half mile measure seems reasonable in an urban neighborhood. But in the suburban style neighborhood, do you look at an equivalent, you know, a 2 mile drive, or, I mean, just isn't even, this doesn't seem like it would ever be possible in a suburban style development to have a park within half a mile of everybody.
Yep. Yeah, it is, to generate 100% walkable access to a park in a sprawling community feels really challenging. And I think if we don't have a dedicated metric for vehicular access, but what I think is probably the more meaningful measure is what's the distance by which you could incorporate a visit to the park into your daily life. So that's the sort of critical sea change that we see in terms of the benefits, the health benefits, both physical and mental health benefits, as well as the social benefits, is when the park becomes, and much like Joanne has talked about, the park becomes ingrained into that pattern of life for a neighborhood. That's when you start to really see the superpowers of the park, if you will. So thinking about that transportation paradigm in an auto-dependent community, how can you make a park accessible to someone in their daily rhythm? Is that a 5 minute out of the way drive? Is that a 3 minute drive? I don't know the right answer, but the measurement really needs to be focused on how can people access this park on a daily basis as part of their rhythm of living in the place. And that's when you really
unlock. That makes a lot of sense. And also, listening to Joanne, I mean, in other places, what's the role of advocacy in seeing, you know, park scores go up? I mean, we do have a local parks advocacy group called Bloom, which is small, but I bet in other places you've seen advocates like Joanne and others ultimately lead to more parks, better parks. But how important is that piece?
It's absolutely critical. When you have informed, engaged, and persistent advocacy for park improvement, it changes the landscape of a city. I'll point to Dallas, Texas as an example. In 2014, they signed on to the 10-minute walk. And it wasn't just that they signed on to this idea of increasing walkable access. Because of concerted advocacy across Dallas, including communities south of the Trinity River that have been under and invested for decades, specifically communities of color, elected officials started saying parks aren't just a nice to have, parks are a right for residents to enjoy. That paradigm shift with Dallas, they have increased park access by 20% in the last 8 years. It's 300,000 people who have gained access to a park who didn't have it.
Wow.
In 2014.
Well, and And I don't want to get too much into the weeds, but I know there's been some discussions here about identifying a permanent recurring funding source. And basically that would be an extra penny on some fee or something that would go into a dedicated fund to pay for a park improvements, but also park maintenance. And of course, that's something voters have to approve. And we know how people like their fees and taxes to go up. And having said that, there's some discussions locally about that. How important are those kinds of, and does Trust for Public Land get involved in helping cities figure out what that looks like?
Great question. And that side of the advocacy coin is one where Trust for Public Land is investing across the country. We have a team called our Conservation Finances team, where they support communities evaluate the feasibility of creating the funding structures necessary to create the funding source, be it a special tax levy or a municipal bond measure that can create those funding sources. And those tools have been incredibly impactful across the country. From the Trust for Public Lands team over the last 30 years, I believe they have generated just shy of $100 billion in conservation funding, $94 billion through measures, just like you mentioned. And we're hovering around the 90% success rate of campaigns taken to the ballot. And that is where advocacy absolutely plays a critical role, because you need community advocates, grassroots organizations working in concert with elected officials, for those elected officials to see there's a broad swell of support for the concept. And then we can look at some of the information. We can look at polls to find out, okay, what are those elements that are most motivating? Take those to the ballot and then work with specialists in the field to get a campaign.
So Joanne, you think you're busy now. If that comes to pass here and there's an opportunity
I'm ready.
To bring that to the voters, we're going to need you.
I think that's going to be great. And they can see their tax dollars at work.
Absolutely.
That's one of the most magical parts of developing a park is when advocates, be it from a kid informing the design of a playground, when they see the transformation because of their voice, that's a very rare thing in the community development space, where you can see someone's voice and advocacy turned into reality in such a relatively short.
Well, that's fantastic. So I guess my last question I usually like to ask people is, Joanne, I'll start with you. What didn't I ask you that you want to say, if anything?
Well, of course, you said so much. I just can't, there's nothing really left. You're a very, very thorough and great host and journalist. I want to thank you for inviting us. This is the right combination. Very perfect. And I can't thank you enough for connecting us.
We got more to meet in person. And I hope, Joanne, I've met you in person. Hopefully, Neil, I hope at some point I have an opportunity to meet you too. But so what about you? Last question. I didn't mean to call you Neil. Sorry about that.
Quite all right. I think probably the last question that I think would be, we talked about this already, but the multiple benefits of parks that communities are rallying behind parks, and this so underlines Joanne, your work with HUG, parks as the home base for neighborhoods. And what that means as it relates to community health, both in terms of mental health service providers, physical health services providers, prescriptions for walking groups coming from family doctors, to meeting for group counseling sessions in the neighborhood park space.
Yes.
All of that being sort of underpinned as the parks as the rallying point for these for community services like that. And I think that's a trend that we are seeing across the country. And Joanne, your work with HUG so epitomizes the real power of parks as a home base for neighborhoods.
Neil, no, thank you. I think parks build communities. And I we were feeding children in one apartment, and one girl says, I want to move over here with my daughter because the parks are so beautiful. And she thought, if we take care of our parks, we'll take care of them as
well. You know, that's a perfect way to end. So you've been listening to Memphis Metropolis on WYXR 91.7 FM. We've been having a fantastic conversation about parks and park access. And my guests have been Noel Durant, who's the Tennessee office of the Trust for Public Land, and then Joanne Street, who's the leader and founder of the HUG Parks Advocacy Group. So thank you both for coming on the show.
Thank you
so much, Emily. Can't wait to meet y'all in person.
Absolutely. This has been great.
You've been listening to Memphis Metropolis on WYXR 91.7 FM. I'm Emily Trenum. Memphis Metropolis airs every Monday at 1, so please tune in again next week. You can listen to past programs on our program page at wyxr.org or on memphismetropolis.com. You can also follow us and send feedback on social media. Now, stay tuned for Memphis Undercover with Nancy.